Produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Hanahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. HanaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645. Hanahola Stringed Instruments.
Garden Island Hydro,
support.
Assisting with all your growing needs. Nutrients, mediums, all-natural compost tea, lights, aquaponic and hydroponic components, systems, and setups. In the Puhi Industrial Park, Lihue. Family-owned and operated. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 246-4769. That's 246-GROW. And online at GardenIslandHydro.com.
Thanks once again to our magnificent underwriters. They all are bursting to tell you about themselves there all at the same time. Robin, it's great to see you.
It is so great to be here.
I love being in the station with you, and we're here as well with Mac. And, we don't have a mic on Mac right now, but this is the Garden Show team today, excited to bring a great show to you all about the plants that make our hearts sing here in the Hawaiian Islands. And it's winter time. The rain is falling. The sky is taking care of the irrigation in some cases. How about at your place?
Yeah, we got a little rain this morning, which was totally great. Although, I have to say, for about 10 days, the wind has just been howling. I'm so happy for some breeze. When you live through a couple weeks without the breeze, you certainly really learn to appreciate it. However, after 10 days of that and not much rain, the plants are really starting to look a little lashed, you know, really getting desiccated and a little tattered. So that rain this morning was really welcome.
Give thanks for that.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a chock-a-block show for you today. We're going to jump right in to our celestial session where we look to the heavenly skies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming techniques that we might choose to do at this particular time. And today's moon phase, once again, brought to us rounding out the great info in the 2014 Hanalei moon and tide calendar. Looking forward to the next one coming out soon. Hanalei Watershed Hui, bringing that to us. Thanks again to them. Astronomical Applications Department of the U.S. Naval Department. Tax money well spent as they keep us up to date with the sun and moon travels. And I know Robin's going to jump into some of that information today as well. Today's Hawaiian moon, Mohalu. And this is in the second of the three Anahulu, or weeks in the Hawaiian moon month. This is Poipoi, which means rounding or full. We are approaching the full moon. But today, Wednesday, Mohalu will rise on Kauai at 3:52 p.m. this afternoon. She'll reach her transit, or her highest point in the sky, at 10:26 p.m., and she will set at 5:03 a.m. tomorrow morning. 92% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated once she rises up. We have the full moon coming up early Saturday morning at 2:27 a.m., and Mohalu, the mana'o, or knowledge of that, it means to open, unfold as flowers. 12th day of the Hawaiian moon month is liked for planting flowers because it is believed the flowers will be round and perfect like the moon on this night. So planting recommendation, flowering plants. And it's funny because Robin and I often sync up the different segments on the show based on as many different coincidences as we can. However, even though this is a Hawaiian moon that celebrates flowering plants, today we will focus on a whole group of plants from non-flowering plants. What sort of plants are those? Well, we'll get into that in a little while, and Robin will give us some botanical knowledge about that as well. So stay tuned.
Sure. Yeah. And and put on your thinking caps. We're going to botanize a little bit here today. Well, interestingly, in the biodynamic look at things, there are no flower recommendations for this week. We always love it when they do line up with the Hawaiian calendar. It makes us feel like we've got double power behind what we're doing. But today, the moon is in Cancer, a water sign, making it a good time to work with our leaf plants. And it is planting time. We are in the descending moon right now, so it is time to get some leaf plants in the ground. I know that I've been anxiously waiting time for romaine lettuces and butterheads and all those cool weather leafy crops. I'm just in hog heaven in there in my garden at the moment. Well, I shouldn't say that, lest my fence get breached by one of those pigs. We'll pray that doesn't happen. Thursday through Saturday, the moon will move into Leo, a fire sign, making it time to work with our fruiting plants. And so beyond fruit trees and long-term plants, we can look at some of the garden stuff like peas. I'm really excited to get some peas growing. Not the time for cucumbers necessarily. I tried a late crop, and they were doing just fine until that wind kicked in, and they just got tattered. I thought I could trick them. But I've learning now over these years, you just can't trick the plants. And we'll get into a little bit more of that in a moment. But Sunday through Tuesday, the moon will be in Virgo, an earth sign, making it time to work with our root plants. This is definitely radish season as well with cool weather. there's plenty of other root crops out there that we could look at. But as the days are shortening here, and they're shortening quickly, we're leading up to our winter solstice, which is going to be later this month, falls exactly on December 21st at around 1:03 p.m. that day. And generally shorter days are going to be triggering plants into flowering. So for those flowering plants, we have basils, lettuces, I mean, almost anything you can think of is going to, it gets a light signal basically by lack of daylight hours that trigger them into flowering. And I say good luck trying to stop that freight train when it gets started, because if you've ever tried to stop a basil from flowering, a nice big full-grown basil, that'll really keep you busy. I mean, once that internal clock of the plant has taken that shift into flowering, it's going to head towards seed production. And Paul and I, on just before the show here, were discussing that, wow, well, we're kind of seed types, so we like the idea of seeds. But there's also certain particular plant crops that whose seed yields us a food product. And one of those would be when cilantro goes to seed. We get what's known as coriander. Or when a dill plant goes to seed, we get what's known as caraway. Anise seed falls into that category, a lesser known and loved relation to the parsley family as well. And were there other ones that I'm forgetting that we talked about?
I think that's what jumped to mind, but Certainly there are more.
There's certainly more. Celery was one. Celery seed, also a great spice to keep in the spice cabinet. And just a little look ahead, I just want to kind of whet people's appetites about this winter time and the winter solstice coming up on it here. And I did a little bit of research last night on day lengths, and I found that, interestingly, starting from December 21st is where I started doing my research, all the way through January 20th. And what I found was interesting is the sunset times never stopped getting later, so the day length increased always by 1 minute on the end of the day. The sun sets 1 minute later each day, all the way up to Tuesday, January 20th, when the sunrise time, which has actually also been getting later by a minute from December 21st. So basically what we have is the same exact day length that keeps marching along, because the sun's rising a minute later and the sun's setting a minute later, until Tuesday, January 20th, which will be the first day that the sun rises a minute earlier than it has. So when we think of solstice as just sort of a one event, it really isn't just one event, and I find it very interesting. So we're going to have this same day length basically for a whole month. It won't change. I find that really fascinating, mostly because we've all been taught that oh, that's the shortest day, and then the days start to get longer. But technically speaking, according to the astronomical observations about sunrise and sunset, we're basically going to have that same day length all the way through January 20th.
That is so surprising and very cool. And great for folks like me who like to correct people. When the solstice comes around, certainly one of the things we hear most often is, oh, it's the shortest day of the year. And in fact, it is. It is one of the shortest days of the year, but it's certainly not the only one.
That's right.
So that's pretty cool.
That's right. And again,
I'm actually teaching myself not to correct people, but I will acknowledge that it's something that I have a propensity to do, so...
Sure. Well, good. I often need correcting, so people like you are valuable in my life as well. I just bring it up to say that the plants are so keen on just moments, just seconds of day length change can really change things for them. And so that's where we're at. We're in these short days and planting recommendations. You know, we want to try to look at things that are really going to produce us some nice produce, and if not, we may consider seed sources from some of those plantings if they don't play out vegetatively quite the way we had hoped.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Great news from the heavens and getting ready for this winter season and all the short days to come. And we are going to share with you right now some notable news. Before we do, though, I do want to wedge in an appreciation from last week. We had an angel donor once we had announced that the air conditioning unit here at KKCR is bust. It still is bust. It still is very hot. Somebody kind has installed a fan in the studio, but it's still very hot here. Our equipment is at risk of both temperature and moisture, continues to be. We're looking at a $20,000 repair. And we had an angel donor who just called out of the blue last week, donated $1,000 on the spot. Again, thank you so much if you're listening. And for anyone else, just know that you too can be an angel donor at any level. Call the station right now at 826-7774, or if you're off island, 866-275-1112. In addition to the air conditioning unit, we were under our goal from the last fund drive. We are looking to gather up some more funds so we can continue broadcasting here. So thank you so much, and it's great to be on the air with you right now, regardless of the temperature.
Yes, big mahalos. You know, we realize out here on the island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that we are the stewards of the island, and it really is up to us to make the things happen here that we would like to see happen. So proactive all the way. And that actually leads me beautifully into some notable news that I wanted to share. Comes around every year right around this time. Speaking of flowering, look up on the hillsides and the valleys and the slopes that are wild and sort of, you know, unmanaged by people, and you're going to see lots of yellow flowers blossoming all over the place. And in a lot of cases, these yellow flowers belong to a choking invasive vine known as wood rose. They're yellow tubular flowers on a big hardy vine that has no trouble climbing a 50-foot tree. Another one of those is cat's claw, which is also kind of a viney, sprawly type of thing with just absolutely evil thorns on it that make it really hard to get rid of. But I wanted to just bring this up. So if you are a landowner here and you have a big piece of land and some of it's unmanaged and you're looking across the hillside and you're noticing these yellow flowers, this is when the plants actually, it is telling you that it's there, whereas during the other parts of the year, it just blends into the greenness that is the hillsides around here, and it's absolutely a prime time to go over there and rid your property or the land that you take care of or steward from such invasive plants, because once they go flowering, guess what comes next? It's going to be seeds, which means a whole another generation of these invasive plants. And there's another one, Paul. Funny enough, we just driving to the station today, he was able to find all three of these growing right along the roadside on the way here, and he did grab some examples. But there's a third one in your hand, which I'm not as familiar with, Paul. Can you talk about that one?
Sure. This is a member of the legume family. It's called Colomona, and it is not the pre-European contact Colomona, but it is a introduced variety. I believe it's a Senna. I meant to look it up before the show, but I did not do so. It's quite common, I know, in the Haupu Na Willy Willy area. I used to trim it to feed goats. They were quite fond of it. It's got beautiful yellow flowers, a nitrogen-fixing shrub that, if it is, I mean, certainly is naturalized and brings up the question of when does a plant cross the boundary from naturalized to invasive, is if it's really crowding out native species, if it's toxic or otherwise causes ecological, economic consequences to the Hawaiian Islands. And this one, I don't know, is really a problem in that way. And as well, we do have, I was actually surprised I was able to approach a cat's claw close enough to get the flower off of it. I took a bit of a risk. There was some cat's claw growing in some wadelia, and I just sort of said a prayer and stepped into the wadelia, hoping that I wouldn't stay there, because this plant really does hold on, and you may find yourself taking some time to extricate yourself from the cat's claw. And I'd say this is really the biggest problem plant that we have. We do have the common wood rose as well, which is difficult to eradicate, is a smothering plant, but doesn't have thorns or toxic elements to it. But boy, this cat's claw is definitely one that if you have it, you want to stop it soon, in the same way that if you have an albizia population that's just starting, you want to get on top of it before it gets out of control.
Absolutely. So, notable news from the hillsides of Kauai, basically giving us a beautiful opportunity to steward our land and protect the natural and native environment here.
Truly. And another yellow invasive that's coming to mind for me is the Kahili ginger.
Yes.
And I don't know if that is if it's the season now for the flowering of the Kahili ginger, which is way beyond control in many parts of upland Kauai, but if it was coming into a new area, it could potentially be controlled.
I was just up in Kokei last week, and I saw a lot of dried up flowers, so I think that they have passed their big bloom time. But yeah, nonetheless, we could go on and on in that vein. There's certainly plenty of plants that are challenging our environments here. Some of them are even cultivated. And not just wild, but moving right along.
Moving right along, we have a second notable news item, this one from Reuters. The story entitled, Genetic Research Could Offer Alternatives to GM Crops. Those would be genetically modified crops. And I'll quote the article here. Advances in understanding the genetic makeup of plants could ultimately help to produce more resilient, higher-yielding crops. The head of a French seed company called Limagrain said, with the potential to end the heated debate over genetic modification. He was quoted as saying, if you get an intimate understanding of a plant, you may get answers via traditional selection without using GMOs. GMOs are an important question, but one that shouldn't be dramatized, said Limagrain president Jean-Yves Foucault. Limagrain is the world's fourth largest seed producer. It currently produces GMO seed used in the U.S., but by and large, it's not used in Europe, which is two-thirds of the market of that company. So great to hear that the president of a major seed company in the world says, hey, we're doing this genetic analysis of the existing genetic makeup of plants, and there's a lot of secrets in there that we can bring forth via traditional breeding and not take the risk of introducing genetically modified organisms to the environment.
Sounds great to me.
Yeah, pretty cool. So we want to let you know This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Coming up in this hour, we're going to confer on conifers, the gymnosperms. We'll also be talking about plant allelopathy. And if you are wondering what in the heck is that, just stay tuned. But right now, we're going to jump into the kitchen garden and appreciate a plant that Robin rolls out a couple of products each time this year that delight my senses. And I think everyone who gets sort of exposed to the wonder of this plant really remarks upon how wonderful it is.
It's true, and I have been biding my time. I will tell you, I've been just absolutely chomping at the bit to talk about one of my favorite kitchen garden plants, and that is Roselle. Roselle hibiscus subdifera. It is in the okra clan of things. It's very similar to okra, but not okra. And the usable part of this plant, just to clear up any confusion, a lot of times people call it hibiscus flower tea or hibiscus tea. And when you're in Hawaii and you say hibiscus, immediately the mind goes to a beautiful hibiscus flower. However, the Roselle part that is used is called the calyx. And the calyx is a botanical term to describe the apparatus that holds a flower. So I ask you to just imagine for a second a marigold flower. And if you're looking at the top of it and you see the fluffy orange or yellow petals, they're very beautiful. You turn it upside down and you see where the stem was connecting, and there's a green sheath that holds all of those petals together. That green sheath is also a calyx. So a calyx is what holds the flower. Now, in most plants, the calyx is not so big or obtuse to the eye. However, in Roselle, that's what it's all about. It's all about the calyx.
And the calyx is really important in the early development of the flower bud, is it not? It's kind of the sheath or the protecting structure of a new flower bud before, in many cases, before it actually opens up.
Sure. I think of a rose blossom, actually, when you say that, and how before it's open, when it's a bud, it's got a green leafy looking capsule on it, and then that slowly opens. That too is a calyx. So in Roselle, the calyx are big and juicy and blood red and just absolutely a feast for the eyes, but they also are totally delicious. They're high in vitamin C, chromium, copper, manganese, iron, selenium, phosphorus. The tea is often what is utilized by putting boiling water over the calyxes and steeping them as a beverage. I like to drink it cold as an iced tea, but warm Roselle is delicious. It combines very well with other tea herbs such as ginger, or one of my favorites, Roselle lemongrass or Roselle lemon verbena. Very good. But it is an old-time loved plant in the Hawaiian Islands. I have a tropical fruit book from the 1930s that's out of print now that has a huge section on recipes for Roselle. Everything from jello molds to jams and the like. And I know that Monkey Paw Jam has been making lots of Roselle now that it's in season. She's gotten her hands on some. So if you're not going to make it yourself, if you are growing this in the backyard garden, you know, we planted them back in the late spring, early summer. The plants put on a lot of vegetative growth. They probably started budding and fruiting sometime in late September. And like the okras, you want to keep picking them. And you like to pick the Roselle calyxes, those buds, when they snap easily off the plant, just like you would want to harvest young okra. If you kind of give a tug on it and it doesn't want to come off, I highly recommend having a little knife or a pair of scissors out there to do your harvesting, because the plant is also grown for fiber in some places, and it is so tough that it will uproot or just strip the whole branch if you really try to fight that thing off of there. You want to clip it. but it's a cooling energy is what the tea has for us. It's that mucilaginous quality that we know comes from okra. It's soothing and cooling. It's a free radical scavenger. It's anti-inflammatory, heart healthy. There's studies out there now that it's even aiding in weight loss. So just an awesome plant to have in the backyard garden. And mine are actually kind of slowing down. I've gotten a huge harvests off of them, maybe four or five harvests, and I see them slowing down. So I believe the rest of the buds that are on there, I'm going to leave for seed collection for next year's plants. But they can be trimmed back if they start to look a little spent, and they will flush out again with pruning and feeding, always a nice combination. And you can get some more harvest off of them through February, I think, if you can keep your plants healthy. So there we have it. One of my absolute favorite plants out there.
Cool.
Roselle.
Robin, we were talking a couple shows ago about the importance in some cases with medicinal herbs or herbs we would use for tea to dry the herb before its use.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is one that you can use fresh or dried. Do you have a preference, and why do you prefer it that way?
I do, and I dry it, and this is why, because the fruits are very perishable when they're fresh, and they do not keep well even in the refrigerator. So my MO is to do a big harvest and then peel the calyxes away from the small nubby okra and to dehydrate the calyxes, and that A, helps them last longer. When you get such a big harvest, I mean, you just can't drink that much liquid. So I have learned over time, I'll brew some fresh, and the truth be told, there's a slightly different fragrance to a fresh Roselle tea than a dried Roselle tea. I actually prefer the fresh one. It's just got a certain taste that's not there once the plant is dried. Now, officially or medicinally, I don't know what the differences are for the healing properties between a fresh one and a dried one, but I know that I can store those dried ones in glass jars, and just two plants grown for this one season gives me enough tea material for the whole year until I start harvesting next year.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing. I know it's always great when we have intimate experience with a plant or procedure, and your relationship with Roselle has been growing year after year, so I especially appreciate the insight that you've shared.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And before we jump into our feature topic for the day, I'd like to just mention a feature website. Once in a while, we like to do this, and the folks over at Organic Seed Alliance, I believe they're based in Washington or Oregon. I think it's Washington. They have a really awesome website. It's osa.org, OSA standing for Organic Seed Alliance. And it's just a fabulous website. There's so much information. They are giving free publications on how to produce seed. They have blank forms for doing variety trials and seed crops, so that when we start in on this kind of activity ourselves, we have a starting point, because a lot of us just wouldn't even know how to create the record-keeping apparatus, and they do have it there. They have it all there. They're encouraging breeding for organic systems and basically genuine and real seed grown on farms for farmers, and I'm just absolutely in love with their work. And there's a little quote that actually came to mind, because these folks are just seem tireless in the work that they're doing. There's conferences and teaching, and the amount of literature on that website alone is unbelievable. And I wanted to just share this quote from The Lorax. We all know, one of our favorite Dr. Seuss characters, and he says, "Unless someone like you cares an awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not." So I know you're out there caring and sharing and loving up the island, and we thank you for that, getting out there and getting your hands in the land every single day.
Yes, I want to echo your appreciation for the work done at OSA. They came and got us started with the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative. John Navazio, Michaela Connolly, and the other folks there just doing an awesome job revising production manuals for different seed crops and being a strong advocate for organic seed. in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the United States and the world, really. So grateful to them and definitely worth a visit to their website.
Yes, and, you know, I'll give you a little bit of a tidbit look ahead for the month of January. We're going to be talking a lot about seeds. We're going to be talking about the state of the seed industry right now and the fragility of our seed sources and some of the great seed growing work that's happening here in the Hawaiian Islands and right here on Kauai. And there's no one better to have this conversation with than Paul, who pretty much single-handedly filled up the seed bank in about 1 year with an outrageous amount of Kauai-grown seed.
With the help of many growers, thank you so much, and so many people, yeah, so many shoulders that I'm standing on and grateful to bring that work forward. So grateful to have that discussion with you too, Robin.
Yeah.
Coming up in January. Right now, we're going to focus in on our plant, I would say family, but it's not a family. And this has led us to a certain discovery process around our division of plants that we're looking at today. We thought
division.
Yes. Yeah, so we thought what would be the ideal grouping of plants to discuss in the month of December, and it seemed like we should talk about the conifers. And I don't know. We came up with the name of Coniferae, and I suppose that it passed both of our close scrutiny that actually this was not a family of plants, but indeed it is a division. And so I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, what does division mean? Sure. That must be a taxonomic term.
It is a taxonomic term, and it's part of the categorization of plant life and all of life on Earth. And there are major kingdoms of organisms, and one of them is Plantae, and that is all the plants. That is divided then into what are called divisions. That's the next more specific designation, but still very general. And those would be currently described as 12 divisions, and these are going to be, I won't go through all the names, but we've got mosses, club mosses, ferns, cycads, ginkgo, conifers, gnetophytes, flowering plants, algaes. These are all different divisions of plants. And one of them is Pinophyta, or Coniferae, or Coniferophyta. These are all these are synonymous names for the division that is the gymnosperms. And commonly they're called conifers. Conifers meaning to bear a cone. And they are generally regarded, according to Wikipedia, right now, 8 families of plants, 68 genera, and 630 species. Compare that to, so we're talking 630 species for the entire division of gymnosperms. And we can compare that to 11,000 ferns, 12,000 mosses, and currently 260,000 species of flowering plants. So 260,000 species compared to 630 species of conifers. Yet we know, everybody knows conifers. We see them everywhere across the world. And even here in Hawaii. They arose 383 million years ago, so they're more ancient than our flowering plants, which appeared 136 million years later. So they were really on the planet, dominating the ecosystems for quite a long time, and they still represent a domination of the world's largest terrestrial biome, which is called the taiga, otherwise known as the boreal forests of the world, which are found in Alaska, northern Canada, Scandinavia, northern Russia, Mongolia, and through to northern Japan. That whole very
ring.
Northern band.
It's kind of a big band around the high north there.
Correct. And yet that's not the only place they're located. Of course, they're found in the more southerly temperate areas of the United States, Europe, and other parts of the world, and Asia and Europe. And it's also found in a lot of dry forests down in Mexico and in that sort of band around the world, too. So there are some tropical, subtropical conifers, but they're much more uncommon, but they're mm-hmm. still present. And they're really good. So why is there only 630 species? Why didn't it diversify into this massive amount like the flowering plants did? Well, they're really good. They're really good at surviving. And so they did a certain amount of speciation where they differentiated from their common ancestor. But then they were so good at subsisting in their environments, they didn't really need to change into so many species, essentially. And that's why we still have them as a major plant group today, even though they arose 383 million years ago.
Sure. The oldest plant, kind of plant or living plant is a bristlecone pine, right, which is a conifer.
Yes.
Well, interestingly, here we go botanizing again, but just to make a little bit of a differentiation, what's a gymnosperm? What does that really mean? Well, in Latin, that means naked seed. And so they lack the hidden parts that angiosperms, or these newer plants, have because they're more primitive. So I'll jump into angiosperm, or the classic flowering plant's mode of reproduction. There's a stamen and an anther and pollen. Those are the boy parts. That's a little sex ed here. And then there's the carpel, which is the female part made up of the stigma, the style, and the ovary or ovule. Girl parts, and basically you have a little marriage of the two, and they're hidden. The seeds produced from these mating of the boy parts and the girl parts are formed hidden inside fruits, and the actual reproductive mechanism parts themselves are kind of tucked away, the ovules hidden. And that was an evolutionary strategy to hide them, whereas these conifers, or the gymnosperm reproduction, as I said, they don't have the hidden parts. So they rely on airborne transport of pollen, which lands directly on a naked ovule, and the ovules in these cone-bearing plants actually sit on each scale of the that makes up these cones. And so the plants make an amazing amount of pollen. I mean, way more, because it's wind dispersed. There's not the kind of insect pollination that happens with a flowering plant.
Have you seen that before, Robin?
I have not.
It's amazing. Robin and I both used to live in Colorado, and that's where I saw the pollen being shed by Douglas fir, probably a coniferous stand of trees in the wind. And this amazing yellow cloud just whoosh, raining
sure.
the pollen on its neighbors.
It just takes one
remarkable.
Grain of that pollen to land on that completely exposed, basically, ovule, which is just hiding on the inner ridge of one of these scales inside a pine cone. And what happens when those two marry up, you get a naked seed. And so for me, descriptively, the most common thing I can think of that people would recognize is a pine nut. Now that is like an evolution of its own, of having this giant seed, but it's born naked. There's no shell on it. It's not covered in any way. And so it's pretty fascinating. It's really pretty fascinating to me.
Very cool. So here in the Hawaiian Islands, we have a surprisingly large number of conifers. You don't see too much diversity if just out on the streets or in neighborhoods or in backyards. We have no native species in the Hawaiian Islands of conifers. Many of the conifers that are found present in the Hawaiian Islands are result of work carried out by the Forestry Department over 100 years now. The Forestry Department was initiated in 1903 in response to the fact that there had been wide-scale elimination of trees across the landscape for all number of different reasons of trees being cut down for use for firewood, clearing land for agriculture, lots of feral animals destroying the forests. And so in the early days, the Forestry Department was purely busying itself with just getting something in the ground, fast-growing trees. Then in the 60s, they turned their focus to the possibility of creating a commercial timber industry, and they were focusing on experimenting with all different kinds of timber trees. And then that lasted for maybe about 15 years, and then the focus went into native species or native habitat conservation, which is really where the focus seems to be in the forestry department these days. Up until now, always the importance was in watershed preservation, the ability of the land to provide fresh drinking water and water for agricultural use. And as we know, watersheds covered with trees capture rainwater, and watersheds that are denuded of trees become parched and dry. And so covering the land with trees, great thing. It would have been great if there'd been more foresight to plant more native trees in the earlier days. But it is interesting that we got so many different kinds of conifers as an experimental plantings, and there's quite a lot of them here on Kauai and throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Conifers very important as building material. If you go into any of the big box stores that sell lumber, we're looking at coniferous wood by
Doug
and
fir and cedars even fall yep. into that category.
And of course, here in the Hawaiian Islands or across the world, they're associated with the winter holidays as they provide our Christmas trees and our holiday wreaths. And we'll be talking about some of the specific uses here for that purpose.
Sure. There was a moment early on when we were starting to develop this topic for everyone that I thought the only conifers were found in the parking lot at Home Depot right now for sale as Christmas trees. But boy, was I wrong.
They are produced here. We have 9 naturalized species of conifers in the Hawaiian Islands, according to the Flora of Hawaiian Islands website. However, it says that there are no naturalized conifers on Kauai, according to that website. I think that must be an oversight with all of the trees. I certainly have seen trees that no way were they planted.
Sure.
That have at least sparingly naturalized.
Well, if you've seen now, very interesting. I personally have interchanged the two names, Norfolk pine and Cook pine. I have used those very interchangeably, confident that they were the same plant, taking note that Norfolk pines are from Norfolk Island and Cook pines are from Cook Island, different islands in the Pacific. And no? You're saying no.
Norfolk Island pine, yes.
Yes.
Cook pine is actually from New Caledonia.
Okay.
Not from an island named Cook.
Cook. Oh.
Yeah, it's the confusion. Cook Island pine is what people commonly say, so it's assumed. But it's actually Norfolk Island pine and the Cook pine, who Captain Cook saw in New Caledonia from a distance. He thought that they looked like columns of basalt or columns of rock.
He didn't think they just looked like new masts for broken ships.
Probably that too. So we're talking about Araucaria is yes. the genus and 2 closely related species. And in fact, if listeners go to the KKCR Facebook page, we did post up a picture thanks to PacificHorticulture.org. Nabbed it off of their website today, so
and
please
Laura
visit
Christine.
PacificHorticulture.org. Check out their fine work. But they had a great photo that illustrated the difference between a Cook pine and a Norfolk Island pine. And maybe this is an extreme example of the difference in terms of the habit or the growth habit of the plant. But in this picture, it demonstrates that the Norfolk pine has a much sparser habit. There's a much greater distance between branches on the main stem of the plant. And we do have both kinds in the Hawaiian Islands, but it's thought that most all of what we have is the Cook pine and infrequently is the Norfolk pine. But the confusion rages on. The Forestry Department actually produces a number of coniferous trees for sale. There is a state tree nursery on the Big Island in Kamuela, and according to a really nice illustrated document that is available on the internet, they have 9 species of conifers produced at that state tree nursery, and one of them being the Cook Island pine. So, is it the Cook Island, or rather, I'm sorry, the Norfolk Island pine, according to their information. Apparently, if you see the seeds of the two, that's the easiest way to tell them apart.
Interesting. Well, in my reading in Permacopia, a great trilogy of books, it is suggested that the Norfolk pine and the Cook pine have hybridized together to create yet a third species that is called the Hawaiian tropical pine. So I'm going to look for an arborist who can tell the difference between those three. That sounds pretty interesting. But that's not the least of it. We do, speaking of forestry projects, I mean, the one that stands out in my mind, Paul, is what we know here on Kauai as Sugi Grove. Mm-hmm. Up in Coquay, back on Campton Road, it's just this grand, beautiful stand of Sugi pines. Where do they fall in this whole?
Well, this is a plant called the Sugi, and it is a Pinus, I believe. No, it's a Cryptomeria japonica, and they get massive, comparable to the big...
redwoods?
Yeah, the redwoods.
Yeah.
Comparable to the redwoods in time, in terms of their size.
And are these cone-bearing, I guess, is my big question. I didn't
quite be
able to find that.
Because it's a conifer.
Yes.
It must be a cone-bearing plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of the species that is available from the state tree nursery. Now, on that note, it's perhaps a bit difficult to find conifers in our local nurseries. They're not... It's probably pretty easy to find one of those Araucarias, whether it be the Cook pine or the Norfolk Island pine. And indeed, Kauai Nursery and Landscape has those available. But many of the other members are not really regularly grown in the nursery trade. One of them that you brought to my attention was the Italian cypress, which we see often I'd say uncommonly, but they're so notable. They're so emblematic.
They're so handsome. Those perfect columns. I mean, when they're perfect, they're perfect.
Yeah.
Really.
Beautiful sort of long arrow pointing toward the sky. And it seems like they would perhaps be more commonly found at nurseries, and occasionally they will be. And then there's the whole group of junipers, which quite a few junipers that have been grown in the Hawaiian Islands. So in order to give you an idea of how much conifers are grown here, this is a difficult thing to research because it spreads across many families. And the Bishop Museum Checklist of Cultivated Plants, which we often used for information, you can't search by division, but in four of the major conifer families that I looked at, there were 22 genera and 71 cultivated species just in those four genera. So there's a lot of them, and cypress and juniper are actually in the same family, Cupressiaceae, and there are 35 species of either cypress or juniper grown in the Hawaiian Islands. Even if there's only maybe one plant or a few plants, people have really tried these plants out in the Hawaiian Islands to great effect. A lot of these plants do thrive at higher elevation, and so the state tree nursery does recommend a number of those conifers that they sell for elevations above 1,000, 1,500, or 2,000 feet. And, of course, it makes sense that state tree nursery is located on Hawaii Island that has elevations up to 13,000 feet. So it's a good match for them.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we will follow up this conversation next week with some information, since it is that time of year when people like to get Christmas trees. And, you know, we can buy imported ones or we can buy locally grown ones. And we're going to give you some tips on how to select a Christmas tree this year.
This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin, and we want to encourage you to stay tuned in the next hour for Kauai Vibrations. With Tracy, I believe, is in the house. We're going to have Shaka Kayaka with the Papule Show at 3 o'clock, and Scott Majaris brings us Kauai Surf Stories at 4 or is it 5? 5 o'clock. Thank you. So stay tuned to KKCR for some great programming. And we are going to jump into our final segment of the show, Secrets of the Soil Builders. We're going to unravel a mystery for you. This is the mystery of allelopathy, or otherwise known as allelopathic agents in plants. Sometimes they are a problem, and sometimes they are our savior as we focus in on different organic methods of production. Sometimes it's the allelopathic agents that really save us. So let's start with a definition of allelopathy. Have you got? I've got it. Okay, so defined as the chemical inhibition of one plant or organism by another due to the release into the environment of substances acting as germination or growth inhibitors. And so we often will find that there are certain invasive or unwanted plants that have allelopathic properties that prevent the establishment of either native species in a native habitat, or maybe even
just anything.
Or maybe even just anything other than itself. Yeah. Exactly. And we do observe. Why don't you share about some of those observations?
Sure. Well, certainly if you've been into a thick ironwood grove, the ground is carpeted so heavily with needles that pretty much not finding anything besides ironwoods growing inside of there.
Right. And they are very thick, so the question is, what is going on here? Is it actually the super thick leaf litter that doesn't let light into the soil that inhibits the growth of them? Is it a root exudate? Is it a leachate from the live leaf, or perhaps even some sort of allelopathic agent that's coming from the decomposition of the leaf litter? These are all possibilities. And there's even another possibility, which is that sometimes there is a symbiotic association with a microorganism living in the rhizosphere or the root zone of the plant that is itself giving off some sort of chemical that inhibits the germination or growth of other plants.
One that I found really interesting here in Hawaii is that mock orange actually exudes volatile vapors and gases from the bark, and they did an experiment with orchids, trying to grow orchids on the branches of mock orange, and the orchids, despite the fact they were given adequate water and had plenty of shade, they just couldn't make it, and it was chalked up to this allelopathic vapor that comes off of the mock orange. So kind of a mild-mannered looking plant, but ooh.
Mm-hmm. And as well as some of those emblematic ones that we can consider, like eucalyptus, we think about some of the considerations are, should we be putting down mulch of this particular tree in our garden or around our garden? And eucalyptus would be an example of one that the mulch, great for pathways where we want to inhibit weed growth, but maybe not so good for our garden beds, where the leachate from chipped wood can actually inhibit the growth of beneficial organisms that make our plants thrive. However, sometimes some of our most common garden plants have allelopathic agents in and of themselves, including asparagus, beans, broccoli, corn, cucumber, sunflowers, and tomatoes. All have some method of allelopathy that allows them to pretty much take control of that little area within their growth habit so that they can thrive. So
sure.
It's a very common strategy, actually, of plants.
Sure, and I know on a future show here we're going to be getting into companion planting, and we can see that sometimes that happens in nature all by itself because plant A really likes what plant B is giving out, so they kind of join up, or we can manufacture that as gardeners and create these relationships by planting these plants next to each other in the garden. One of the most fascinating ones I read about was the sun hemp. Sun hemp leachate actually has been proven to paralyze the root knot nematode. And this research was done by Kunhui Wang, who we had on the show last year, or earlier this year, rather, when we were talking about nematodes. And she found that when chopped and incorporated, the perlization continued. So just the dripping off of the leaves, the leachate from the leaves, was paralyzing the nematodes under the soil. But then when you chop it and turn it in, it was even stronger. And basically a paralyzed nematode is a hungry nematode because it can't move around to get food. And it basically starves to death under there. So it's a really neat way to control nematodes. We've talked about how some hemp is good to combat nematodes, but not so specifically on what's really happening under there.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that, in contrast with marigolds, which have another allelopathic strategy, which is primarily based again on research by Dr. Kunhui Wang that demonstrated that it's a root exudate from a living plant that really has the powerful action against nematodes rather than the incorporation into the soil. So that would be in contrast with sun hemp. So using both in combination, we also know that Sudan grass, and I didn't look up the allelopathic property, whether it is any one of the potential factors of a living plant, a dead plant, but what we know is that growing Sudan grass has some allelopathic effect on nematodes as well, and grows very well with sun hemp too, and as well the velvet bean that we've been experimenting with too in the food forest also has allelopathic properties. One last thing that I would share before we go to announcements that came to my realization based on reading a short paper by a UH researcher was that allelopathic agents actually play a role in succession, which we talked about last week. And one of the biggest challenges we have in the food forest is that the grasses, which are our greatest weed challenge, aren't really getting succeeded so easily. They're inhibited by shade that eventually develops in the food forest, but the grasses are kind of always wanting to grow if there's enough sun. Yet if we do some more research and we discover plant species that have allelopathic agents that assist in succession, perhaps we might be able to incorporate those species into the food forest and limit the grass problem, the weed problem that we're having. So I'm excited to do more research in that area.
Yeah. So although before this morning I thought allelopathy was only bad, now I realize that it can actually have positive effects as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's lots going on right now, so we'll jump into some announcements. And I know not the least of which is a food forest orientation this Saturday, right, Paul?
That's right. We're getting started on monthly orientations to invite new folks in. It'll be our opportunity also for seasoned food forest stewards to walk the project, make observations, and see how we can transform and improve month by month our management strategies. But if you're brand new to the food forest, you want to come and get a tour, the opportunity is this Saturday and the first Saturday of every month, and it's at 10 a.m., and that'll go for a couple hours. We'll take a break, and then we have an organizational meeting where perhaps you could share your observations and get involved in a committee or another action group with the food forest, which is located up in Kalihiwai. And for more information directions, you can go to ribg.org for directions on how to get there and join us. As well, we're excited to be celebrating the fifth annual Waipa Tarot Festival coming up this Sunday. It's the 7th of December. It's 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and it's located at the beautiful Ha'ulu Fish Pond, which is Makai of the Highway, in the Ahupua'a of Waipa, which is 1/2 mile past Hanalei toward the end of the road. It'll feature poi pounding, makahiki games, a water slide, live local music, the biggest kalo contest.
Woohoo! The Queen's Challenge.
Yes,
been waiting all year for this.
Great food, so much more. And as well, preceding Sunday's Kalo Fest are some workshops.
Yeah, the pre-festival grower workshops at Waipa on Saturday, December 6th, from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., followed by a potluck lunch and talk story with our dear brother Uncle Jerry Konanui. The workshops will cover phytosanitation of taro for best sharing, farming and Aina practice, Aina Mo soil conditioner, and taro varieties identification. These workshops are free and open to the public, but please register to reserve your space by calling 826-9969.
And finally, we'd like to let you know about a special presentation at the NTBG Education Center in Kalaheo, Revisiting Origins and Relationships of the California Flora, with visiting lecturer Dr. Bruce Baldwin from the Jepson Herbarium and Integrative Biology Department at UC Berkeley. Go to ntbg.org for more information. That will be Thursday, tomorrow, December 4th, from noon.